This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hey, everybody. Just a quick note from me. We are releasing this episode on Monday, September 8th, 2025, not our usual Friday schedule. And there's a reason for that. Not only is it Geek Takeover Week 2025, but it is also Star Trek Day. On this date in 1966, on September 8th, the original series, the original Star Trek debuted, making it 59 years old to date. So what better guest to have than Dr. Trek himself, Larry Nemechek. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Fox Nomad podcast. I'm your host, Fox Nomad. Today is our Geek Takeover Week special. So in 2012 or so, I decided that in August every year, I would just on foxnomad.com write about whatever I wanted. And it happened to be Star Trek a lot of the time, although it might be something science or historical or something with anthropology. It would just be about some kind of specific interest that I had, no matter what it happened to be. Now, it's come over into the podcast as well since I started the Fox Nomad podcast. And every season, we start off the season with the Geek Takeover Week. This year, I'm making it the first episode of the season, so we can kick off with a big Geek Takeover Week episode. And I have a fantastic guest for you today. My guest is Larry Nemechek. He is known as Dr. Trek. He is so integrated into the world of Star Trek knowledge. We're going to talk about the new shows. We're going to talk about Star Trek fandom. We're going to talk about the tours that he runs in Los Angeles, where you can visit some of the sites that were part of Star Trek episodes that you, if you watch Star Trek, are probably familiar with, or if you've seen it, any of the movies. We also talk about the big tour that he runs at the end of July, beginning of August. That is right before the Las Vegas Star Trek convention. I hope you enjoy this episode with Dr. Trek. Thanks, Larry, for joining the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on. We've got a lot to talk about, both Star Trek and the intersection, as you put it, of Star Trek and travel, which I love. It's two of my favorite things. Maybe you could start off by introducing yourself just a little bit. There's so much to cover.
Well, thank you, Anil, for having me on. This is awesome. I'm always glad to evangelize Trek beyond the typical spaces, because that's the way Star Trek is. It's not from the beginning. It was never about, you know, kids or sci-fi nerds. I mean, Gene Roddenberry himself used to talk about busting that stereotype. We have for the Trek Files that I do for Roddenberry podcasts, we have, which always is based on letters and memos and things from his files. We have a letter he wrote to someone at the time, but he was talking about how he'd go on airplane flights and he'd be on a flight and he would meet doctors, lawyers, you know, accountants, school teachers, people of all walks who were closet Star Trek fans. And they tended to be over 30 in the 60s. So, you know, there you go. But no, thank you for this. And I always, it's wacky. This whole Dr. Trek thing just started because I was, when we were first becoming entrepreneurs and all going off and doing our own blogs and podcasts and things in the beginning, I needed something shorter than author, editor, interviewer, archivist, historian, host, you know, collector. And I wanted something shorter, and finally I was kind of pushed into doing that. But no, I've been a Trek fan since I was a NASA kid first, I would say, because when I was a kid was when the moon landings were happening and a little before. And I have memories of, you know, my mom and dad, everybody would, everything would stop and we'd run in the living room to watch the launches, you know, the early space launches, because it was one of those moments. And I had NASA posters and things on my wall. And so my, it was my ninth grade science teacher, Mrs. Pollard, her name's different now, but one day that she and some kids were goofing around and I didn't get what they were doing. And I said, "What is this?" And the bottom line was she wound up saying, "Oh, Larry, don't tell me you don't know Star Trek." And I was like, "Is that the show with the guy with the ears?" So we were in the rerun days by then after school. So she was like, "You have to go home right now and watch this show." So within a couple of weeks, I was pretty hooked, although it kind of crept up on me. It was after school, and what else was I going to do those days? But I think that's why it's funny how years later you go and you look back, and then within a year or two or three, fandom was finding itself. I feel like I'm a second generation fan, but the generation before the motion picture. I kind of came in halfway through the revival era, right? And everything about Star Trek was breaking the norms. Like there was nothing like it in pop culture. This was before Star Wars, like a couple of years before Star Wars. And, you know, dead TV shows didn't come back to life. People didn't show up and pay money to go to conventions about dead TV shows. That wasn't a thing. And of course, we didn't have modern media and phones and social media and take home TV and movie, you know, have it at home. You were still having to watch everything on TV. There was no VHS tape, much less DVD or cable or anything really. Anyway, that's the world that I came up in. And you had to have a real job. I wound up going into journalism, and I have a theater background because I wanted to add to that. I was going to go into radio and TV and wound up in print. But it never, Star Trek didn't go away in a bunch of different interests that I had. I was a stamp collector and model trains and built models and did model rocketry. And I loved history most of all. And that's kind of, so many people wrote fan fiction, you know, and some people would do costumes, and my mom made me some uniforms and that kind of thing, or they would build models. And I did some of that too, but it was the background, the universe of Star Trek. Today we call it world building. And we have all these terms for things that didn't exist when Star Trek started. And I say Star Trek forced us to have the internet before the internet. We had a paper and stamps internet because it made people want that much information and that much communication. So anyway, that was the world I came out of, and eventually wanted to flesh out the background more, eventually worked on my own star charts and blended astronomy and real world astronomy with that, and almost got published, and then went away and got a graduate degree and then worked in news. And Next Generation came along, and I wanted an encyclopedia the way B.J. Trimble had done the original concordance for the first show. And doing that got me in touch with the offices at Paramount, because I was just a kid in Oklahoma in the middle of the country. And basically, things started happening very quickly. But a lot of things happened together. It was the desktop publishing and laser printers. Anyway, my self-published books impressed people, got me the contract to do the Next Generation companion book against all odds. And I didn't know it was a competition, but apparently it was. And after that, a couple of years later, we moved to LA, and I started doing all kinds of consulting work, and the original StarTrek.com was managing editor for that and was the first chat guest, and the book went through two or three editions, and I worked on the experience in Vegas. And so this whole synergy of things was happening, and it was great, and Star Trek was bubbling up. They built the experience in Las Vegas, the conventions and the world tour and all these things. And then the world fell apart in 05. You know, the Berman era ended. Viacom divorce happened. Nobody I worked with or knew was working in Star Trek. It was just kind of a wasteland. I called it the fallow years. And even when the JJ movies came back, it was a different thing because they kept them to themselves and there was nothing at the Paramount lot. And We got into this entrepreneur era when nobody had any rules written. And eventually people figured out that there was a way to monetize that. And so instead of being a word guy, I slowly became a podcast guest and then a host and you too. But got a chance to do the stellar cartography maps, which was my old star mapping interest, came back. So it's been, I mean, this is why it was, this is never a 10-word sentence.
No, it's, I mean, I totally understand. And it's
kind of wacky.
But the through line is Star Trek, right? It's always kind of seems like it's been there in and out, mixing with your other interests.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm a huge history. Now, again, I worked on the star charts and I love that as a sidewalk astronomer. I have no degree in astronomy. I have no degree in history, but I'm a huge history fan before science fiction came out. And that was what drew me to Star Trek. The world building, I loved the way there was a cohesive universe. That was the goal, and they increasingly made it so. But I also love the way, and all these things are like unspoken things I wasn't conscious of until years later. And you say, well, why did this happen? And you look back and reflect. And I just enjoyed history. And I was, my dad and mom were both, my dad was a World War II veteran. My mom, came up through the Depression. So their generation was a big interest to me, and the movies and the music and everything. I didn't hate my own time, but I just loved finding that out and knowing that and reading about it. And my hero, I'm an Oklahoman, my hero's Will Rogers, who was the first really stand-up comedian commentator, did the monologue and all of that. And what I loved about Star Trek was, without realizing it at first, was every time Kirk would make a speech and say, they would do one of those history spanning to explain the moment. They've got Khan Noonien and Singh here, and he'd say, think about it. Caesar, Napoleon, Hitler, Lee Kuan, and he would do one of those strings of history to get you into the moment and explain the Star Trek context. But it always reinforced the fact that they are us. I love Star Wars, but that was a galaxy far, far away, long ago, that had nothing to do with us, except it was a cool adventure. And there was just something about...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Knowing that there's a through line from us to them, the old trope about Star Trek fans was, it's optimistic, and we got through pollution and nuclear war and prejudice and hate and any other problem that's plaguing us now. We got through it to bring it to the galaxy, hopefully. And that was never front of mind to me. To me, it was just us getting forward, and it was nice that we survived. As Gene Roddenberry would say, if we don't figure these things out, we're never going to get that far. Like, we won't be out here exploring the cosmos if we haven't figured all our problems out, because we would have self-destructed somewhere along the way, mm-hmm. And it's not that I was a depressed kid that celebrated that the way a lot of people did, and good for them. Star Trek gave a lot of people hope, has given a lot of people hope and optimism. And they also lets people kind of wallow around in the geekery science, cell phones and tricorders and everything about Star Trek that's influenced the look of the future and vice versa. And NASA and Star Trek have had this great mutual love affair. The individuals and so many people have gone into careers, science and beyond science because of Star Trek. But to me, I was just fascinated that it had this history, that it built on real science, real history, projected into the future. And then was a cool story that had characters and all that. But I realized early on that I was not a typical fan, because so many people wanted to read fiction or write fiction. And then eventually people, you know, did cosplay. We didn't have that word then, but I had my niche that I enjoyed. And part of that was filling out the universe, fleshing out the universe and smoothing out the bumps in the canon before we worried about it. We just did it. And then weirdly, when I got the chance to do the companion book years later, I've been doing an encyclopedia and collecting facts. And they said, well, Mike and Diddy Sakuta are going to do this. We need you to do a making of book, the way the great making of Star Trek was. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I love that too. I just had to do it in 3 months, which was insane for the first edition. But I love that too, because I love the making of the shows, the decisions that were made, the roads not taken, you know, the inspirations for the writers and art and visual effects and costuming and props and the way the machine works, the way all the gears fit together. And amazingly, it was that original making of Star Trek book from the 60s. I didn't know it at the time. I thought I was reading a book about how Star Trek was made. There were no books out, paperback, mass market books out to tell lay people how TV is made. The whole generation grew up figuring out, you know, what a set dresser is from reading the making of Star Trek. And anyway, it blended to me because I went into theater partly later on. But so that's kind of what I enjoy doing now. It's helping smooth out Star Trek and also helping explain it to people, and where Star Trek intersects business and fandom and mm-hmm. TV. And that's kind of where I've basically found my need. That's what Dr. Trek kind of is.
Yeah. And now the fandom and the show has just grown so much, right? We're having another revival of Star Trek, maybe a little bit past the peak of the current revival. I'm not sure, but, there's now so much, I mean, Star Trek, I feel like it is bigger in a way than it has before. How do you like see the evolution of the show and the fandom and compare it to the early days? Like, is this where you expected it would be, or is this?
Yeah. Well, it's because it feels like there have been eras of Star Trek. I just like Star Wars and Doctor Who have all kind of ebbed and flowed since they, you know, they get anything that catches on with the public, with the fandom, obviously starts off hot. And then at some point cools down a little bit for whatever reason, either the creator passes on or it's a financial where the original network or distributor decides it's gotten old and creaky and people don't want to watch, or something in the media changes. And that, all of that's what's been interesting about affecting Star Trek. But Star Trek's DNA is in a fandom that saved it. They talk about fans taking ownership of something, which annoys a studio who actually owns the IP, maybe. But there would be no Star Trek making money for Paramount if it wasn't for that first generation of fans doing everything. They celebrated the show, but they also demanded a rebirth. And of course, then it went through the animated series, but then a movie, then another movie, then a TV series, then back to a movie as they figured, the financial landscape for media was changing at the same time people were trying to figure out what was happening with Star Trek. And then Star Trek inspired Star Wars. So then people woke up and at Paramount and said, what do we have? Oh, we have that Star Trek thing. Let's do that. So it's had these peaks and valleys, and then the movie series, and then no one thought of Star Trek beyond Kirk, Spock, McCoy in the Enterprise until Next Generation, when that wasn't going to be feasible to have Shatner and Nimoy and DeForest Kelly keep playing their roles getting older. And they didn't want to recast them. That seemed like, you know, a taboo. So they just said, well, let's keep this universe and go 80 years down the road and make it look updated. And 20 years have gone by in real science and culture and TV technology. Let's do this and let's syndicate it, not put it on a network. So we're not on the bubble all the time and worried about being canceled. And it was like a three-way, you know, new paradigm that worked. After a couple of creaky years, they hit their stride. Everything's a boom. They have spinoffs. There are going to be movies. And then as fast as the boom happened, I think it kind of outgrew TV. So by the time we get to DS9 and Voyager and Enterprise, The audience seems to be shifting or declining or it's split up or it's a victim of its own success and other sci-fi shows have come along, you know, sci-fi fantasy. So there were a lot of reasons why there was this malaise and people thought, well, Star Trek's tired out. It had a good 20-year run here on phase two and it needs to go away for 10 or 20 years. Well, the JJ movies brought that back in a different way. I would disagree back then because the fan ownership was going to a new level. You didn't just write fan fiction. Now you could make your own movies. And when YouTubing and everything went online in the beginning, the early aughts, I say it took, you know, you'd have dial up and it took 15 minutes to get a 10-minute segment downloaded. But very quickly, you know, we had the YouTube revolution and then everything went online. And YouTube, you know, fan film producers were making their own Star Trek at the same time Star Trek was supposed to be dead. So the whole media world was changing too, and things were going off paper to, I call it dead tree media now. Everything was shifting online, digital, but the rules weren't written yet. Nobody knew exactly where it was all going. And that's where the JJ movies happened, but even they didn't take over. They didn't exploit Star Trek. And then finally, it was the streaming revolution that brought current Star Trek back. And everything about Star Trek now has been driven by the medium and Paramount wanting to do something. Paramount was the first one to have its own streaming channel before Disney and before everybody else. It was CBS All Access, I should say. And that was, you know, just the way UPN had been, Voyager had helped launch UPN. Paramount's going to launch its new era of technology media with a Star Trek because they know that's their strongest suit. So Discovery starts out off and it has a lot of growing pains. And we, you know, within a few years, streaming explodes, led by Netflix, and now it's retrenching and people are trying to figure out what it is. And are we just going to wind up? Anyway, Star Trek is once again like kind of tied to the technology and the media while it's trying to invent new things. Like what does serialized Star Trek look like versus standalone? But it's these last 8 years now have been amazing. Now, whether it's, like you said, whether it's as big as it was in the peak, I think it is. People never thought Next Gen would ever lead to something bigger than the original series. And it did. And now people are having a hard time thinking, will it be bigger than Next Generation and DS9 and Voyager and all the legacy shows? I think it will. I think it's just the impact, the ripple effect hasn't gotten there yet. Scare is that we go away and there is no Star Trek for, you know, there was no Star Trek in the beginning because it had to prove itself. And then there was no Star Trek for small screen adventure Star Trek for 12 years. Now, is Paramount going to be stupid enough to let in a world where Hollywood craves, you know, established IP and franchises, are they really going to let Star Trek go away that long? And now we have the new ownership at Paramount. And what are they going to do about Star Trek, much less what they're going to do about movies and TV, linear TV and streaming. And apparently they're going to not run away from streaming. But are we going to ever have five shows again, although they're 10 episode seasons? I mean, you know what I mean? It's a whole new landscape and the fandom's been getting used to that as well as still celebrating the old. The old shows are more popular now than they were because of binging. DS9 drove people crazy because it was the first steps toward a serialized show. And people in the old days, oh, I've missed 2 weeks in a row. I have to give up watching it. Well, that's insanity to somebody now, to a kid now.
Yeah. Yeah. What's funny is that every time a new Star Trek comes out, there are the fans that say, this is not Star Trek. And then 10, 20 years down the line, you get all these fans. I'll say, you know, Discovery, maybe, you know, I think in the fandom it's a little controversial, I guess. Some people love it, some people don't. But I'm certain in 15, 20 years, we're going to have, the conventions are going to be full of people who Discovery was their show. And that defines Star Trek to them. So, as someone who knows so much about all of the Trek, is there one thing that it is that keeps the franchise popular, or is it just different for everybody? You know, is it picking?
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself. When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere. Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
And choose. Like, we have so many great things to choose from. Or is it one thing?
I know. This is the question that's... They ask actors, yeah. They ask fans, they ask the creators. And it does kind of ebb and flow different aspects, but I still think it's us in the future being diverse, optimistic, you know, embracing science, embracing rationality, embracing tolerance. Because as Gene said, I mean, it's kind of a moot point. It's like, well, if we weren't, we wouldn't be there. We would have self-destructed along the way. You can have all your cool outer space, you know, sci-fi, but you don't, how are you going to have dystopian future sci-fi without explaining how we got through it now? Unless you get into a dystopia in the future. And a couple of times, Star Trek and the Utopia Federation has played with maybe going down a dark path, and then it gets pulled back. And that's the plot of the future. But to get to there as a platform, it's like, you know, it's just in the DNA. It has to be, or it makes no sense. So if you want the cool sci-fi adventure of the future, just on a surface level, you've got to make these assumptions in the past. And so making those assumptions in the past is what still is the underlying, you know, message of Star Trek. It's the only thing, aside from maybe Doctor Who, it's the only franchise out there that has not had it's not dystopian people kind of coming back from disaster, you know, whatever it is, including Star Wars. And now on top of that, I would say, well, there's a lot of cool you know, the storytelling involves cool characters, cool writing, cool situations, and then of course the storytelling, the little morality plays. Right, the metaphors for current issues, especially with the original series, and then not quite as often through all the modern shows, but still very much there. And even in just if the whole plot of an episode or a season wasn't about, you know, something socially relevant, it shines through in the moments. The people come from that kind of a universe. Again, they have to, or they wouldn't have survived this long to be at this level of culture and technology. So that, and then it's just what I still say sets Star Trek apart from everything else that's out there. Because I was never a comic book fan, but I've had met comic book fans since who talk about how they were inspired by the diversity and the inclusion of comic books. And I go, oh, really? Of Marvel or DC? I'm like, oh, really? That's in comic book? That's in superhero comic books? Really? I thought just everybody running around zapping each other with their superpowers and the villain dies, you know, is put away at the end. So I get it that people find their inspiration, you know, their aspirational desire through all kinds of sci-fi, fantasy, all that. But what sets Star Trek apart to me, as manic as the comic fans are and the Star Wars fans are, now Star Trek wanted to have this unified universe, and through all the decades so far has managed to pretty much keep it. And that's one thing about fandom. They love to debate, you know, canon and, oh, they got this wrong and, oh, we have to fix this. But I think Star Trek has been the most unified of all of them. And so to me, I used to have a thing where I said this five C's of Star Trek. And I think it was concept, commentary, cast, characters, and continuity or canon. And everybody else has all of those except for Star Trek's devotion, which gets kidded about a lot, right? And I think some of the shows got away from that, or they think about concept canon without visual canon. And that turned a lot of people off. So that's kind of the through line. Star Trek will always be futuristic, science-embracing, aspirational, you know, tolerance and idic, in infinite diversity and infinite combinations, the old Vulcan phrase. We didn't think about how relevant that would be the way it is now back in the 60s. I think it just sounded good and people got it intellectually. Mm-hmm. And now it's literally people like cling to that with their lives in some ways.
Yeah.
So and their devotion to Star Trek.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say that my answer to that question has changed over the years, but Robert Hewitt Wolff, one of the writers for Deep Space Nine, he had an interview where he said basically what his thought was that it's smart people working together to competently solve problems, something along those lines. And I was like, yeah, I think that that's what I like about it. They're acting in the sort of the almost the best way that humans can work together, rather than, you know, one person wants to do this and one, you know, there are, you know, obviously there's some conflict, you know, among the decision making,
competing priorities of the moment, maybe. Yeah,
but so it's interesting how that sort of changes. But I think there are elements to it that you bring up that keep bringing people back to the franchise. Otherwise, it wouldn't be this popular. I mean,
yeah. And at the time, you know, what's been interesting is what social media, I mean, you talked about every iteration of Star Trek has had people complaining about it or mad about it, but it starts. People are shocked when Discovery debuted and we had the whole new element of a really advanced social media had been around for 10 years by then. I'm thinking Facebook and Twitter to start. And there was all this pushback. And it also happened right as we were getting smart about social media. And, you know, about the time Discovery premiered was Gamergate had been right before that, the attack on, you know, the misogynistic attack on women in gaming, which was just weird. It's like, where did this come from? And it wasn't my arena, but you saw it going by. And then when it's like, well, Star Trek's back and now it's big enough to be on the radar screen of these people. And it wasn't fandom doing that. It was the outsiders attacking. Oh, you've got two women of color in the lead here of this Discovery show. And that's ridiculous. And you're like, what? That's not Star Trek. And you're like, oh, Star Trek is so woke. Well, by that definition, Star Trek's always been woke. You know, it's like, well, who are you people? And a lot of them weren't people, and a lot of them were totally new. They was the whole phenomenon of trolling and bots and just social disruption. It's like, well, congratulations, Star Trek. You have now reemerged big enough from your fallow years to get onto this radar, you know, and be part of this. Because in the old days, yeah, you would have maybe, I used to call it the loud 10% when we were in paper and stamp days. And you can go back to the best letter comment zine was called Interstat. And I remember when Next Generation came down the pike and all the people that loved the original series so much, especially the people from fan fiction world who were so invested, the phrases, stop me if you've heard this before. Oh, they're just going to slap Star Trek on this and expect us to take it, you know. They're just going to wipe away the memory of all the, you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. How dare they think we're just going to forget them and go with this new thing? And I was a kid thinking, shut up. Gene is running this. They're not being forgotten. They've gone 80 years in the future. They could have rebooted Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, but they recast them, but they didn't. And that was even before that was a thing. That was even before we had 14 Batmans and 92 Spider-Men in 5 years, it felt like. And I just didn't understand that. But what it taught me then, and it's happened every day, it's not that people want to hate the new Star Trek. It's, I think, people love it so much that they are fearful for losing what they love so much. And some people, it reminds me of Grandpa or my Aunt Mary, to this literally saved my life, you know. Those stories, people who are at verge of suicide, or they needed a way through their coming out of the closet, or their trans, or their racial issues, or the abusive home situation, kids, you know, veterans and PTSD. I mean, you name it, Star Trek, there are stories, and actors can recite the stories that people have told, fans have told them. When you get to that level of passion by that big a chunk of people, not maybe all coming from some kind of a trauma, maybe it's the people just really love the show, But they're afraid of something being changed. And it's really, it's weird how it's easy to go from fear of losing what you have to anger about the change. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I know when the new Klingons came, were done for Discovery and made so many people mad, I saw, aside from just reading people angry online, live, I saw Mary Chifo and Ken live at Star Trek Vegas. And a guy who was a little short and a little rotund, but he was totally decked out in his Klingon. And he was at the Q&A line, and he came up to, and the show had not aired yet, but this was the August before the September premiere. And this Klingon fan, who was not 14, he was probably in his 30s or 40s at least. And he said, look, I'm glad to hear you all talking about that. They were talking about the controversy and trying to reassure fans. And this fan said, I'm thrilled to hear you all talk this way. I'm glad you're here talking to us. But just to know, my fear is that this thing I have loved my entire life is going to go away. And I heard him say that, and it kind of crystallized a lot of it, the sincere fan controversies, if you want to call it that. And I get it that there's a lot of people that love it so much, their fear sometimes spills over to as hate or just anger. And, you know, people who may not be the most, the oldest and have been around the block a long time, and they'll just be blunt. But that's mm-hmm. different from the bot and troll factory that came up. But the combination of all that has made the last 10 years or so really, really different, because before you had to write a letter and get it out there, and people did, and mm-hmm. there were the naysayers. You know, DS9 was the show that didn't go anywhere because they sat still, and Voyager was just lost in space, you know, for Star Trek, and Enterprise was a prequel, and I want my Star Trek to go forward in time, which always seemed.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Ridiculous to me, because I wanted prequels. I didn't care. It was Star Trek. And 2151 was still in the future to me.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway, it's looking at fandom that way. It's like, well, the penalty Star Trek pays for being popular for 60 years is that people, the good news is people care a lot about it. And the bad news is people care an awful lot about it.
Yeah, and people love Enterprise now. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's. I feel like everyone, you know, is like, oh, it was a really good show. And da-da-da. I was like, well, at the time, I don't, you know, people weren't, and I'm sure if it had aired now. But you know, I think you bring up a good point. It's like the Star Trek that you love is still there, right? The series that you like, they don't go away, and it's going to change. I mean, there's. Like if you look at TOS and Next Generation, I mean, the Klingons are, I mean, if you just want to talk about Klingons, right? Like it's going to change. It's going to be in different ownership, different writers, mm-hmm. different times, different technologies. It's just inevitable.
Different media, different delivery systems, different budgets,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Like they couldn't make a show today that looked like TOS, right? Like, you know, in Strange New Worlds, they have to update it for modern audiences. I mean, they it would be ridiculous for them not to, I think.
Well, see, this is where I'm not about. I have a philosophy too. I see people rail and rail. Like when Discovery started, there were the haters, just the crazy people, misogynists, and you know all that. But then there were the people who sincerely said, "This looks far too advanced to be 10 years before Kirk and Spock." Mm-hmm. flat screens and long distance holograms. That's ridiculous. And then people said, well, you can't make it like 1966 because the 2017 audience won't buy it. And my point was, well, did you not see In a Mirror Darkly on Enterprise, which was the which was an Enterprise, the Constitution class. It was the Enterprise, but it was the Defiant in Archer's time, but it was shot in HD. It was shot in 2005. And what that proved to me at the time, I was like, well, looky there. See, look how good that that design looks. But they did make updates. They just did it subtly. And my point was, in this whole debate as Discovery kicked off, was on top of everything else, people not liking it on a paid channel that you had to pay for and figure out, and all the other things that people, that was such a huge leap and a new look, and the Klingons, and Michael Burnham being a foster sister to Spock, and all of that conceptual, the visual threw a lot of people. And my point was, you could have, I hear what you're saying, because that's what it means, people said. And there's a lot of truth. Of course, you can't show, you can't do it. But part of this is, there have been fan films that tried to make the 1960s look and fail. I mean, you can't exactly replicate it. You can't help but let your modern times get in the way of trying to replicate that. My point was, it's not, you can design it, have the basic lines and angles and palette. Then what you bring modern time to it is the way you shoot it, edit it, frame it, light it, yada, 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 on down. There's a difference to me between production design and cinematography. And you could have had an adapted, not, you could have new materials. You'd have to use plywood for everything and Christmas lights. You could have had, you know, thankfully, new material, but have the lines and the look be the same, the design be the same, and then shoot it for today. And which is what they did on In a Mirror Darkly, but this would have been another 10 years beyond that. And I think, I still think that would have held up in a way. Or are we in for Trials and Tribulations? They did the 30th anniversary show for DS9, where Sisko and his crew are back with Kirk during the Tribbles episode. What they did, what the visual effects did with the models was ingenious. They built an Enterprise and a Klingon battle D7 and the K7 space station. But because they had such little, you know, crude models of the other two, they wanted to have more detail and push in. And they did. They built the models with a ton more detail. They look great on camera. And the explanation was that in the 60s, we never got close enough to them to see all this detail that now a modern audience would need. So it's you know, the guy that did the blueprints, the fan that did the blueprints for the bridge in the 70s came up with that. Well, no, they're not just buttons with no labels. Every station has overlays that are multiple, you know, that are changeable. And so if you're trained on this station, you can program it for different things. And his blueprints basically had like a, you could overlay this with seven different layouts. And it could, so people were like retconning everything about the 60s that was getting outdated, the basic look. And so anyway, I'm just saying that a lot of that could have been taken into account. And at the same time, you've got designers and modern craftsmen who don't want to get a paycheck for building something that's 50 years old. You give them the challenge of saying, okay, you're going to take this look, but you're going to make it the best we can make it today. So use new materials, use some new outlooks and tweaks and do some bit, but that's your challenge, is to make it look like it was just built for today, but take the basic lines and design from then. And if you give them that kind of a challenge, it's not repetition, and they might have, you know, jumped on it. So yeah. Anyway, that's my soapbox. I'll stick with it.
No. It's an interesting point. I guess the arguments are always, you know, for me, you know, I can make, like, those leaps aren't the big ones. It's some, maybe the story or the, there are other things that I will nitpick on,
I know. And see, that's a thing that when Discovery came out, the creators were talking about, oh no, we're going to stick to canon. And they did an amazing, and it's the first time in my life I ever thought of this as, it's almost like two spheres of the, like, left-handed and right-handed canon. That what, when they said canon, they talked about concept canon, and like having Michael Burnham be Spock's heretofore unknown foster sister, or Sarek's foster daughter, Sarek and Amanda's people were like upset. I said, well, you had Cybok come out of nowhere to be the unknown half brother, right? In 89. So it's like, we've been here before. And you have some people go, yeah, and I didn't like that either. Okay, fine. Well, you go away. All I'm trying to say is they had slotted everything into the canon timeline. They did an amazing job of making this all work conceptually. Where they had a blind spot was the visual. I had never thought about canon being split into conceptual and visual like that before. Every time they said, oh no, this is going to be canon, they meant it's going to be conceptual canon. It's going to be idea word canon, not looks canon. Because people are, what do you mean it's canon? They've got touchscreens. They don't have, you know, they've got long distance holocoms. What do you mean it's canon? And it was like, oh, we have a blind spot here. And that was the thinking. And it's like, but I also am a realist. And I have this phrase that's like, the ship has sailed. Now it's up to us to deal with it one way or another. And I joked after the first, and what was interesting to me to find out that the writers who eventually wound up with the show, because Discovery was birthed in chaos, the writers who wound up by the end of the first season didn't like all those things either and thought they were ridiculous, but they were stuck with them because they were already paid for, you know. And so then they, and I had a joke. I said, well, they're going to find out in about 2 years that touchscreens and long-distance holocoms cause cancer. And they kind of had something like, you know, Pike comes aboard and says, oh, we've had these mechanical problems with, we've had problems with these holocoms. Get rid of the holoviewers. Go back to flat screens. You know, or even 3D flat screens or whatever. And it was the same idea, only, you know, a little different. So anyway, they were immediately kind of figuring all this out as they went along. And so, yeah, but we could do this for 3 hours. The way we all deal with this. But yeah, I mean, obviously people love the stories. My point was always that the thing that sets Star Trek apart from all the other cool, aspirational, future-looking story franchises was it trying to keep a unified universe and not just give up and reboot every few years or whatever. And yeah. And that's what I hate to see. That's what I hate to see unravel. Now, the realist in me also knows that in 50 years, we may figure out a way to do hyperlight drive for real. And it has nothing to do with the lithium, which is not really a real element. Until we find it on the fifth moon of Jupiter, which is the story for dilithium, you know, or a Maddy antimatter reaction engine may not be the thing that power, you know, when all of that finally just is in our face is not real. I don't know if I want to be around. Well, I won't be around for 50 years, but to worry about it, but, or whenever, 100 years, whatever it is, or when the Vulcans don't really get here in 2061, you know, it'll be so disappointing.
Yeah. There will be people in Bozeman for sure.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
Oh, yeah. I'm amazed Bozeman, Montana hasn't jumped, their Chamber of Commerce hasn't jumped up and put up a big Zefram Cochran statue, you know, yet.
Yeah, like Vulcan Canada. They've taken the mantle. But, you know, we talk about the realism, but there are real places where these, you know, shows were filmed. And you run tours to these different places. Now, if there's any show, there's maybe one where I was like, I want to go see where that was filmed. But aside from Star Trek, but to go to these places and to show people these places, can you talk a little bit about those? Because I'm really fascinated by that.
Yeah.
By going to where these places were filmed, both the legacy, I think the newer stuff probably is, you know, I guess they're all on a green screen or, you know,
well,
AR or something.
There's actual, yeah, you're talking about location. So most of the new stuff is all up around Toronto anyway. So it's all up there, but there are some locations they've gone to. It's not all on that AR augment reality wall that they do. They've used that for weird planets, but for structures and things, they've gone out locally or for otter backgrounds or whatever. But no, it's something that I hadn't thought about. Now, for years, people, the iconic, not that it's, I mean, it's one of the classic episodes. It's not a huge one. I think it's made more huge by two things. One, the location, Vasquez Rocks, are iconic. And two, It was the slow motion fight of the century with Kirk and the Gorn captain, which now has been brought back into relevance because the Gorn are back, right, in Strange New World. And people are trying to retcon all that. And by the way, I have a head retcon for exactly why the Gorn did what it did with Kirk. But that episode is classic for those rocks. And as it dawned on people where they were, if they're around people in Southern California, knew exactly what it was, Vasquez Rocks up northeast of Los Angeles. And people around the country through Star Trek backgrounding, again, as we both said, Star Trek has taught so many people about how TV worked in the first place, much less the way Star Trek worked. And the whole thing about locations. Now, if you're a sci-fi fan, especially, there's been sci-fi movies shot all over the place out in weird, you know, trying to be alien planets, and people have that. And if you're a huge Western fan, you might know where a lot of the Western backdrops were, and over in Arizona, Monument Valley, and, you know, all of that. But the iconic Star Trek place is Vasquez Rocks. What's funky is they shot, over the years in the series, there have been 10, 12 different times they've gone out there, including on Picard just recently, where they called Vasquez Rocks, which was odd. Because Raffi, the character of Raffi, was living out there in her high-tech trailer. But no, that's the thing. And it was just kind of an informal thing. And as I learned about them, or as I worked on the other series with the making, with the companion, just reporting, working in news here and following the productions, my wife worked on Voyager for 5 years, and being and knowing what call sheets are, a great diary of the daily workings of a show. They're a great historical thing to have. It's literally like a diary. The who and the where and the what and the when. Figuring out, knowing when they would go out to location for something. DS9 would be in a quarry to be on an alien planet a lot of times, or some futuristic house. Whatever it was they were at, to know that, it was kind of cool to keep collecting that. And when we had friends come in town, we'd say, who was a Trek fan, they'd say, Larry, can you take me over to Vasquez Rocks, or can we go to Bronson Canyon? And I'm like, sure, see the cave, sure. And it wasn't until about 10, 12 years ago, after the 08 crash, that a person came up to me at the Trek Vegas convention, I guess in 2010, I guess, and said, hi, I started a geek tour company, a niche tour company, after the crash. I'm a travel operator, travel agent, and all my business dried up. Nobody had any money for spare, you know, for fun spending, recreational spending. But I wanted to start this company to see if we could pull people into it. And now we go to historical and military sites and gaming cons. But I wondered, do you think a Star Trek tour would work? And I had wanted to do a book about the tour sites because I had the call sheets. And the original series ones are so iconic, the hardcore fact, like when were they actually here, kind of a thing, just for the completest. And I said, yeah, I think so. And so by 2012, we had put this multi-day traditional that you think of as a tour, where you're together with other people and you stay in a hotel and you go out every day on a bus or a van. And we married it to the week before the Vegas convention, so that at the end of it, everybody on the bus wound up in Vegas at the Rio. And after the first year, we tried to go up in the mountains. But after that, we went out to the Valley of Fire, which is an hour on the other side of Vegas, where Kirk died in Star Trek Generations, right? And Picard and the Rock, you know, all of that. And a lot of funky surprise things connected to the movie were out there that we didn't realize that we discovered too. And that was a lot of fun. And a lot of people got it. But I didn't really get it. I guess there's so much about Star Trek that I feel like I was spoiled about in a weird way. Everything from some people who are just, you know, their Star Trek is in their DNA because, as I said before, it saved their life, or it saved them from craziness, or it got them out of a mundane existence, or it brought them so many friends they never thought they'd have and took them play. You know, it's just, in one way or another, it capital S saved their life, or little s saved their life, enriched their life. And because of X, Y, and Z. And I would say, well, yeah. Like, I took all that for granted. Now let's get on to this fun stuff. And a lot of people are like, okay, well, here we're at the places. This is very cool. And so many people, the first time they see the Vasquez Rocks or they go to the Tillman Water Plant and see Starfleet there from the Berman shows, they're just like a kid on Christmas morning. And the first time or two, it was like, oh. And then completely apart from Star Trek, I'm reading about the generational change. We used to get souvenir plates from my grandma and she had her plate wall. Are collector's plates a thing now? No, because the new gens just want experiences, right? It's like nobody has room for stuff. They want experiences and live in the moment. And it's like, oh, I get it. I see fans the first time they go to something iconic. And sometimes when it's not so iconic and you have to show them a clip and go, oh, look, see, this is this and this is this. And then they're gobsmacked. Either way, I was gobsmacked when I realized what a potential new thing this is in a world that's looking for something new and enriching. And if you're a Star Trek fan, it's one thing to watch the shows that you love till you can say every line. It's another thing for someone like me to bring you, like Portal 47 does, or the Trek Files, our podcast, bring you more context and more texture from the creators to understand something or to know what was going on behind the scenes. But then to take that kind of feeling and then live it and be there in person. And, you know, and the people that cosplay and do, you know, and stand in front of Tillman and want the, you know, in a cadet row or something, or they reenact, they get their Kirk shirt on and go act like they're fighting the Gorn at Vasquez or whatever. There's a woman that loves Vasquez Rocks. I just had on a tour. She loves Who Watches the Watchers on TNG with the Mintakans, the proto-Vulcans. And at the end of that, they give Picard the tapestry that he takes home with him, and it's on his chair from then to the end of the series and in the movies. And even in Picard the series, they remade a new tapestry to hang over his chair. It's the little thing. It's, again, it's part of why Star Trek hangs together as a universe so well, because people cared to do that kind of thing and kept the continuity in the canon. And this woman, she was like, yeah. I want to go to Vasquez Rocks. And I'm thinking, well, the Gorn, you know, there was more than the Gorn. She goes, oh, I know. Can we go to Tapestry Rock? And I go, do you mean the rock at the end they're all sitting on when Nerea gives Picard the tapestry? She goes, yes, I love that show. I love that moment. And so for that person, that fan, that made her whole, that made her week, that made her month, that made her year. She showed me a picture of the tapestry she had commissioned an artist to, you know, not a cosplay, not a model. She wanted that tapestry. And that was the biggest thing to her. And we sat down and took pictures. And I said, yeah, I think we can do that. And we were lining up everything with the clips. And for that kind of a thing. And then I had another, within a month of that, this has all been this year because they've kind of made a comeback out of the blue for some interesting reason. I had a young couple who were planning to get married. They both worked in the industry. He was in Montreal wanting to come to LA. I was saying good luck on this, the way this year's going. But she was here working already as an assistant director. And they were getting married and they both had their favorite episodes. One was Darmok and Jalad. And one was The Inner Light. And both of them, the one location, one was very location, one used one scene, but they were both in Bronson Canyon and both cave. And they wanted to go there because they wanted to come back later on and get engaged there later in the week. And I said, sure, that's it. That's easy. We'll go there. And so there's 15 other things to point out there too. And we went through it. We'd been there for several, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And I went over where the Darmok and Jalad area was. And they were like, oh, this is so cool. This is so cool. And then she said, oh, to hell with it. Let's do this now. And reached in and pulled out their engagement rings. And they kneeled down and they had a little ceremony they wanted to say for each other. And I felt like I was 9 years behind. I was talking and over here and I had my camera and I was holding some of their stuff and I was holding my book. And I looked over and like, you're both on your knees. Oh, are we doing this now? Oh, wait, you want a picture of this? Oh, wait, hold on. And they just went ahead and they went. And I said, guys, can you start over? Let me get a video of this. And they were in their zone. They were not paying attention to me, which was why it was so sweet. But I started taping wherever I could start taping. And they went through their whole little, you know, it was almost like wedding vows, only it was engagement vows. And I was just like, wow, I've never had anybody get engaged in the tour yet. I haven't done that many, just a few dozen, but, you know, a couple of dozen. But I was like, wow. So between that and Tapestry Rock, I mean, it's just fans are fans. Everybody has their moment. And it just taught me again. It's just incredibly awesome when you can come up with a model, with a paradigm that lets Star Trek fans have one more way to, you know, experience Star Trek, but also to, you know, you can pose in your cosplay. Or I had people that had action figures they took on vacations with them. And one woman, every picture, everywhere we went, we had to have Dixon Hill Picard and Beverly and Threshold Tom Paris with the removable tongue going reptilian.
Interesting.
They had to be in every picture we took. We'd pose them on rocks at Vasquez. We took them to, you know, all the places we went, they had to have pictures with them in the scene. It's like whatever somebody wants to do, I'm there to help them out with it. But this was my day tour. These are my day tours that I started doing after I realized that not everybody could afford the big tour that Terrace and Geek Nation Tours does. And we're going to have, it's been between the pandemic and all that, it's been 10 years. We're going to offer that next year in the week before the Vegas convention. But any time of year, I just say, if you're coming to LA and you have a spare day, I said, Star Trek fans are entitled to their own tour, because you could take a, you know, the old days when you could take the actors home. Here's the map to the stars' homes, and people would drive around Beverly Hills and something, and, you know, goes back to Lucy days at least. But, you know, all kinds of, you could take a tour of where actors committed suicide, kind of a thing, just, you know, dark stuff. And I said, I think Star Trek fans deserve a tour when they're in LA and Hollywood to do that. And so that's a one day. So on one hand, he's called me in and we work together on these big tours every 2 or 3 years, except it's been a while now. But my one day, my Trekland Treks is always available. And these times that I've talked about people, these stories, the couple that got engaged, that's been just on my day tour, because it's like, let's sit down and get four places that you want to go to that work and make sense with traffic and everything. And that's what I do for them. And then pick them up and we concierge. I chauffeur them for the day. It's like 6 hours. We get four stops in and we have a fast food lunch. But either way, if you want to go big or you want to go small, it's hard to, I talk about this intellectually all the time, but to viscerally get there, people just break out with the biggest smile, you know. And it doesn't matter if you're an original series, you've got those. If you're next generation, you have these. If you're DS9 and Voyager, you know, you have these. And a lot of times those even overlap. But it's just been amazing. It's the challenge has been to spread the word. So thank you on this part of fandom that's out there in potential. And just kind of, you know, just being able to blow people's minds. Here's actually something new you can do with Star Trek and your fandom and your enjoyment. And I thought I'd seen a lot until this year, and I saw the couple get engaged.
Wow. Yeah, I will definitely leave links to where people can find the tours, both the big one and the day tours, because I mean, you know, as a Star Trek fan, like to go to those places, like just hearing it, I can imagine what it's like to actually be there where, you know, and the thing is, like you mentioned, right? There's all these ways to get into Star Trek. Everybody has like the Tapestry. That's something that's very specific that spoke to that woman, you know, but for somebody listening, that it might be some other episode. It might be some other moment that they can experience. And to add that to a trip to Los Angeles, for example, if they're in LA or if they're going to the Star Trek convention.
Or if they're here for business and they can add on a day for themselves and they want to do that, you know.
And is it sort of make your own tour? Like they maybe they'll get in touch and say, will they give you episodes, or how does it work with the planning?
Yeah, well, what I start with, well, the big tour is a set schedule, obviously, and that's geeknationtours.com. People can go there. The new one for next year is up, or it's about to be up. But my dates, if they go to either LarryNemechek.com or TreklandTreks.com, that takes you right there. And basically, I say, look, here's a menu of 50 places. We'll do, I have it broken down to, it's a day tour. I try to pick people up between 9 and 10, because there's no point in fighting traffic in the morning, especially depending on what we're doing. And then the idea is that we have talked about it. We've pre-planned this. So yes, I send them the list. Here's how I structure. Here's the pricing. Here's the list of places. I have them divided into two columns, bigs and littles. Larger, like you want to spend more time here. It takes longer to get here, whatever. And then smaller stops. And so the day is two larger and two smaller for most, with a couple of exceptions. It breaks down that way. So people reach out to me. I send them the information back. We start talking if they want to go ahead and go on. And then it's like, well, what is your day? Is it a weekend or a weekday? Because that'll be a different dynamic on traffic. And I try to handle, you know, people are intimidated about LA traffic anyway, maybe. So whatever it is, or they're just not familiar, or they don't drive, or whatever it is, I try to take all that away from their concern. Just let them have the day to enjoy it. But we're smart about it up front, and we pre-plan as best we can, you know, or if they want to go to two points that are obviously, they're like 80 miles apart, and then we're going to do two other things, like that's not going to happen. So I try to build a smart itinerary with them that's going to make sense for the day and the timing. And so hopefully we don't have any surprises on the day that get in the way. So.
And these are all beautiful places on their own, right? Like, I mean, when you talk about Vasquez Rocks, when you talk about these other sites, right? Even if maybe they have a companion who's not a Star Trek fan or...
Yes. Terrace has a word for that. I forget what he calls it, but he has... Because a lot of the... Like going out to Santa Monica Pier, thank you, Voyager, when they time traveled in 1996, you can go out and enjoy the pier and the Santa Monica Beach while we're out there for the bits for Future's End. So yeah, there are the Griffith Observatory. You're up there for, again, Future's End and the van and Tom Paris and Sarah Silverman's character and Tuvok had the shootout with the bad guy, but you're in LA, you're at the Griffith Observatory. And if, you know, now we don't have the time to go enjoy the observatory, but you're up there at least for a few minutes and can take all that and enjoy it. So, if you have a plus one, most of the time they'll enjoy coming along just to see the sights and getting on. Not every place, but Tillman, Vasquez Rocks, all those places I mentioned are doubly interesting, I think, for the mundanes. That's the old school word for not fan. for them to enjoy too. And I would say on the big trip, and on the smaller one too, our day tour, you can bring a plus one along who might not be the biggest fan, but I think they'd get a kick out of all the places, just as places to visit, depending on what we choose, of course. But the vast majority of them, I think, are just fun places to visit.
Cool. Well, I will leave links to where everybody can find you. They can find the tours. The day tours, I guess you can book those throughout the year. And then you've got the pre-Vegas convention tour, which I guess would be end of July, early August.
Yeah, it'll be that week. It'll be I think we start on July 30th, and then it leads. Now, you don't have to attend the Vegas convention. You can start in LA, wind up in Vegas, and then take off. Or you can have your own Vegas week, or you can take off from there and continue your travel. But that's what we've set up, because most everyone enjoys that experience. And plus, the cool thing about the big tour is, as Terrace always says, if you're coming to Vegas for the first time and don't know anybody, well, you will meet people very quickly because it's Star Trek fans. But the tour is a great way to meet some friends if you haven't, you know, if you're a solo traveler and don't have anybody with you and it's your first time in LA or Vegas, It's a great way to meet people on your way there. And by the time you walk in the door on Tuesday night or Wednesday, you've been with 10 or 12 or 15 people for a time. So you've got friends already, which is just another one of the spinoffs of the big tour that way.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great way to start a convention, you know, and plus you get all the Star Trek knowledge, which, you know, I mean, I could ask you about, I have so many questions. I wish we had time. I would just ask you a whole bunch of stuff.
Oh, I sucked all the oxygen out of the room. I'm sorry.
No. Not at all. Not at all. I mean, okay, fine. I'll sneak one in.
Okay.
This, since we're in currently Strange New World season 3, people have said, and I have noticed, it's a little bit up and down in terms of episode tone, let's just say. which seems like a departure from the first two seasons. And I think it's been a little bit controversial season 3. I think, you know, people are starting to, I mean, you had a recent episode of your live stream that you talked about this, you know, is the honeymoon over? I wonder what your thoughts are. Is it really that different, or are they setting us up for something? Or, you know, what do you make of this season? Because I feel like it is different.
Well, what day is this? There's two episodes left. Mm-hmm. So part of this, we talk about the season. These modern series that only have 10 episodes, or even when Discovery started and they had 15, 14, 13, 12. But these 10 episode seasons, everything is so precious as to time. And I think that's what's driving a lot of people's frustration. If it was a 26 episode, and people have verbalized that, they've said, look, if we had 20, 25, 26 episodes again, I wouldn't mind these, but you've only got 10 and you've only got 10 plus six to end the whole series with. So I think that's driving some of it. They're not upset with the episodes per se. They just feel like the ticking clock is going to rob. Again, they care so much about the show that they are upset about losing something. And that's driving some, but a lot of people are just a little whacked out by the nature and all that. I'm going to wait till the end of the season to look back. Right now, I have like an initial reaction, but I already realize I see it's crazy at the range of reactions, especially these last couple. The documentary show, What is Starfleet? And then 4.5 Vulcans. And I've seen people come up with things that I never would have thought of. People talk about 4.5 Vulcans in terms of like being anti-representational and I go, what? And so there's some of this I just feel like has to simmer down and let it cool off and look at it in hindsight. But it's clear that this season is not being received the way the first two were. And I don't know if it's a thing of the producer writers and then the actors looking at the crossover show and the musical last year as being really hits and spectacular and thinking, okay, what else can we do that's cool? And just kind of indulging themselves without having this attitude about, you know, no one who works on this show ever did a 26 season episode. Well, am I right here? Yeah. No one there ever did a 26 episode season. Now we get the Academy. Bob Picardo sure did a 26 episode season. He'll be part of this. But they're thinking we're working hard and working a long time, and they're getting to spend 2 weeks on an episode, not 7 days, you know, it's twice as long. So they're feeling like they're working a long time, and they worked through a pandemic and they worked through writer strike. So it's felt like a ton of work to them. But at the end result is to a fan, it's only 10 1 hours, not 26 1 hours. So I don't know that was ever on their radar. And the fourth season's done. It's in the can. So now they're working on the last six episodes of season five. So I don't know. I don't think this didn't have a chance to filter to this fourth season. So we're going to see the fourth season put together, maybe with a few tweaks, but we're going to see it put together still in the mode of what drove them for season three, I think. And then the last season, the six episodes of five will actually maybe start reflecting some of this, or maybe some of this will die down just as fans and the audience, you know, recycle and see everything. But, you know, do the sharp corners get worn down in our perception?
Yeah, It'll be interesting. But it's different.
Yeah.
It is different, right? Okay.
It is different reaction.
Yeah. Well, you know, I find this season interesting. Just as a side note, is some episodes I really like. So I'll always go online and I'll go on Reddit and I'll check out, you know, listen to podcasts and read the comments. And some people will really not like what I liked or really like what I didn't like. So, you know, to me, I'm always like, all right, well, there's something for everybody. You know, everybody likes certain elements. You know, they gravitate more toward, you know, light episodes or darker episodes or this character or that character and so on. So I always find that interesting. And then I go, all right, well, my opinion is just as valid as everybody else's, you know.
Two or three times this last episode, I saw people I know, not just rando fans and podcasts, but people I know. And I'm like, oh, well, didn't see that coming, you know. But the main thing is, are they sincere? I mean, the days, like I said, those Discovery days when there was just so much garbage in the ether, on the interwebs. And it was just like, it wasn't, and you know, I say on my show, I always say, check the sources. Like, are those real people? Look and see if it's somebody screaming for 19 posts, but they only have 2 followers and they just started last week. I mean, come on, you know, check it out. You gotta defend yourself for the current world. You gotta get savvy about the world we live in now. So I think the world's accelerated, but I go back to the days when people were so frustrated with DS9 because it didn't go to a planet every week and they didn't go anywhere and they just sat on that station and the same people said the same stuff and didn't go anywhere every week. And that drove people crazy. But also then when they started doing the runners, what we call serialized storytelling then, but they were just in baby steps and people gave up. And it took the Netflix revolution for people. The popularity of DS9 is tripled, quadrupled what it was on its original run. And I knew intellectually that Voyager was important for having a woman captain, but I could not tell what I call Janeway's army now. The impression that it had wasn't my chromosomes. I was trying to understand, but the anticipation of what Janeway and Seven did for so many, you know, young women, all up and down the line, you couldn't do that. And then I have my disappointments in Enterprise, but it's so appreciated now, way more than it was back in the day, which I thought was unfair then. And it's the show that got canceled right when it was getting really good. For a host of reasons, but it's my point is time will do that. And then it's been wacky to see the original series pendulum swing back and forth and back and forth, how it was old and tired. And then it was retro cool. And then it was, oh, it's so 60s. I can't stand it. And it's gonna, you know, it's the reason we're all here. So, I mean, that's at the core of everything. And for some reason they keep thinking they have to go back and reboot it, you know, or go back to another universe with it. So the impact of the original series is not going to go away either, but it just may shift big time over time. So time is interesting. And I said when Discovery was under some, you know, there was a controversy every week. And I'm like, I can't wait to come back and see this in 5 years or 10 years. Well, it's already been 8 years for the first season. So I think we're due for that, some of that. So we'll see.
Yeah, no, that's interesting take. I like to look at the cosplay at the convention, and especially at Las Vegas, and I'm noticing more and more disco cosplay. You see more uniforms. So like there's a gradual shift. I'm like, I wonder what that's going to be like, you know, in a decade from now.
Well, and we haven't even mentioned this, and you're seeing more Enterprise cosplay, I think, too. The other thing that blew, remember how nervous people were about having a comedy cartoon? And now Lower Decks, I think, is the most beloved thing ever. And how much Lower Decks cosplay? How many attendees do you see at a convention, right? So I'm just waiting for and Prodigy never got enough, as much love as it deserved. A lot of people still think it's a kid's show, and it's, oh my God, it's, by the time it ended, it's such an amazing, I say canon show, and I don't say that to damn it, but yeah, the time. See, part of this is what gets me is that part of that hate mail about Next Generation's beginning, there's a little bit of arrogance. I don't think intentional, but people just get into their, they're a kid, they're a fan, they have to take slings and arrows for being a fan. They enjoy what they do. They make their friends. Maybe they make a name for themselves in fandom, or maybe they go on beyond that. But they're on this track. And you don't think about it. It's just your life. It's your track. It's you and your trek. It's you and your trek track. But eventually, at some point, that track can turn into a rut. Mm-hmm. And if 10 or 20 years have gone by and you haven't, you know, peeked up around, you know, popped up out of your gopher hole to see what's going on in the world, and the new trek comes down the line, you might still be going at it from your rut, from your track, and not realize that the world has changed, or the media has changed, or the generations have changed, or the way people, you know, and sometimes that catches you off guard, as it did when all the, all the old women fan fiction writers were griping about Next Gen, and I was a young kid going, shut up, it's Gene's show. What are you complaining? This is what we wanted. We wanted Trek back. You didn't want them to recast your guys. They're still part of the universe. They didn't wipe them out. What is wrong with you? You know, kind of a thing. And every generation has that. But part of it is I didn't have a voice. They did then. And I think part of this is, when a new show comes out, we hear from the people afraid for it. Still a lot of people cheering. But I think the people who are going to be, you know, who are going to fall in love with it and find it, hopefully, are the people, they don't necessarily know where to go. They know they're supposed to go to this magazine or this website or this board or this app or this Reddit/R. You know, they don't know they're supposed to go there and all start reporting in and talk about how they, you know. There's clusters that are happening by the established fans. So the people that made make the huge turnaround in 20 years for this fandom of this series, there we don't hear from them for 5 or 10 or 15 years. Now, that's accelerating with the pace of life. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
That's why things do change. And you're like, well, where have you all been? Well, I've always thought this. I didn't know I was supposed to report in and tell my opinions here, 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 and here.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's, I also think those controversies keep Star Trek enduring, right? It's like people are very passionate. Unfortunately, you know, or, you know, it can turn into some people just being angry all the time. But I think for the most part, yeah, for the most part, the debates are, you know, they're interesting. Like, hey, does this fit canon? Or maybe they should have done this, or I really like that. You know, that's what keeps it alive. It's all the stuff that's happening off the screen. It's all the conversations and, yeah, you know, debates.
Well, I know a lot of people got depressed at the beginning of Discovery, not because about the show, but about the fandom. And they were, and this was also 2017, and we just had an election. And people are already conscious about all these. It felt like so many people were coming out from under the rocks. Like, what? And it felt like that had happened to fandom too. And in a way it did, but they weren't real people. They were bots and trolls. They weren't real fans. And the bottom line to this was what I started dawning on me was people look at online fandom and assume that's all fandom. It's like, no, it's the people who want to spend some time, good or bad. And the bad tend to be, half of them tend to be being paid for it. But it's people who have the time to be online and know where to go to be in those spaces again. And I really started coming up with this idea of, you know, most of fandom I call armchair fandom. They're just people who want to come home from work, or their kids that come home from school, and they just want to watch Star Trek. They just want to sit at home and watch Trek. And maybe they buy a book or a comic, or maybe they buy an action figure, but they just want to sit home. They don't care about the big debates going on. They had their opinions, maybe. And maybe they have a friend or two they talk to. And that's it. And that's the great unwashed, unknown chunk of, like, how do you get to those people? But also, how do they sound off? What are they thinking? But it's what you see online is a fraction of all of that. And then going to a convention is its own fandom. That's only the fans that can afford to go to a convention and have the wherewithal and the awareness to go to a convention. So you can't even judge fandom by what it's still a barometer, and it's still better than nothing. And it's the highest of the high. And even the people who are at their first convention probably intend to come back for more, and probably they've reached a plateau. And you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it's like when you're in these communities, like, don't make the mistake of thinking everything you see online is all Star Trek fandom, because it's not. I think there's just a huge unwashed bunch of people out there who are still just sitting home watching the shows, enjoying, sharing them with their family, their kids, or dragging their parents, or sitting down with their grandma to watch, you know, their grandpa to watch it, or their Uncle Fred. And that's just happening despite what happened. But the other thing is, convention fandom, the worst, those trolls and bots, you never meet anybody. Nobody comes to a convention, but spends that money, gets there, and then sits around and trashes everything else. They'll spout their opinions. They're good old bar buddy debates, what I'll call, right, that we have. And that's perfectly fine. And that's what keeps it fresh. You've always got people with their soapbox, right? But that's fandom. That's like sports fandom. That's like, you know, people want to have good natured debates. That's good old fandom about anything. And that's always been there. And that's healthy and good. But I used to call them the toxic tubers when that explosion happened. Like, I know one year they tried to come to Vegas, and it's not like people surrounded them and, you know, hooted at them or stoned them. They just kind of wound up clustered off. I saw one time a little table of them at one of the diners, like over by themselves. They weren't running around confronting people with their opinions. They kind of were like cowed, because the overwhelming majority of people are there. They're paying money to be there for a reason, because they love the stuff.
Yeah.
And anyway, I just say in real life, everybody's got their little circle of fan friends. And there's one in the bunch that you just want to punch him sometimes. But they're a fan and they are sincere in what they think, right? Yeah. And they'll be online, and as long as somebody's coming at it sincerely with their beliefs, and you know them, when you know them personally, you don't think that way. When you see it online and you don't know the person, sometimes we had to learn how to be nice online and how to tell the difference. And those people exist online and they're there, but I try to always tell when someone is sincerely, they might be sincerely hurting, and the hurt turns into the anger, like saying earlier. So anyway, it's been like this whole psychology media, you know, as we learned about the dangers of algorithms anyway, mm-hmm. on Facebook and Twitter, you kind of had to learn that for, you know, and people trying to make a buck with their clickbait, whatever, or their hateful clickbait or whatever. But it's like we've had to educate ourselves in general anyway. And I think people feel better about fandom now maybe than they did 5 or 10 years ago, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
because I think fandom is still basically the same old fandom we've always known. It's just we've been rocked a little bit around the edges.
Yeah, it's an interesting take. I think we'll have to come back and take a look at this episode about season 3. I'll be curious in a few years.
Oh, sorry, that all came out of, what do you think about season 3?
No, but you make a good point. It's it's right. You have to, like you said, you know, fandom is not one thing, and yep. There are some
one monolith,
and then a lot of people online, right, like you said, you know, there's some loud voices that are always negative, because that drives engagement a lot of times. So but yeah, I don't know, I think, like you said, the people watching at home, the normal debates that we all have, I think that keeps the fandom going. It's why people still want to go to Vasquez Rocks, right? Tapestry was, what, 92, 91, maybe, that episode aired. So, you know, but there's something in the fandom that really attaches to people, that they want to go to these places and just be there, you know, that it they're not looking
makes
at
it real. It makes it come alive. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the Santa Monica Pier, right? It's that scene in Voyager to them. Like, you're looking at it through the Star Trek lens.
Yeah.
Which is great. So I will leave links to where everybody can find the tours, where they can find you. You're also streaming and podcasting as well. Where are some of the places that people can find you? What times do you go live?
Well, the live show is every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. I say 1 o'clock ish. When I have a guest, we're right at 1 o'clock. Sometimes I'm a little slower. But 1 Pacific, 4 Eastern for Trekland Tuesdays live. And then when there is a fresh Trek episode, I do my own. I don't call it a review show. I call it a reaction show. That's call it Second Opinion with Dr. Trek or Dr. Mm-hmm. Trek's Second Opinion. That's usually out by Saturday after the show airs, because I kind of let the first wave go by and not give a hot take or a quick take, but try to let something and also give people information they might not have heard other places too, or reactions and takes. So that's Second Opinion and my Tuesdays Live. The Trek Files is my podcast from Roddenberry. It's only about 20 minutes a week, and it's always a guest and something out of Gene's actual archives and files, a letter or a memo or a script note or something, photo and artwork. And we are coming back for, we've had 13 seasons, and our 14th season debut is this week, tomorrow. I say tomorrow, September 2nd. You can get in with the 14th season. It's all there at thetrekfiles.com, which is a new page on Memory Alpha that has a player and the document of the week and then all the hot links. But we're on all the podcast sites. George Takei is our premier guest for the 14th season. And we're talking about, it's the 60th anniversary this year of filming Where No Man's Gone Before, the second pilot that sold the series. And so George is remembering as a young actor what it was like to be involved with that shooting and with that filming and what they were thinking at the time and what this, you know, what was going on. So that's been special. But that's the Trek Files from Roddenberry. And then Portal 47 is all this backstageness as a package every month subscription with a guest every month and roundtables and things out of my archives. So
yeah,
where the world went business-wise is Portal 47 and the Trekland Treks. And then we have the Trek Files and Tuesday Live. And oh, and for Prodigy fans, my granddaughter is amazing. So we have Cadet Alice and Dr. Trek Watch Prodigy.
Great. Yeah. Well, and Prodigy definitely needs more love and support. So, you know, it's great that you're both covering Prodigy.
And my YouTube channel got in late, so it needs love and support too. So if everybody could go like and subscribe on Trekland YouTube, that would be great.
And if you're watching on YouTube, I will leave a link to all of these places in the description. If you're listening to the audio, that will also be in the show notes. So people can find you. It's been a lot of fun talking to you about both the tours and Star Trek and just fandom in general. You've kind of opened my eyes into different ways of thinking about how people react to Star Trek and what Star Trek is. You know, it's
well, that's great, Anil. I mean, I was always a fat guy, right? I wanted to flesh out the canon. I wanted to know and about 2010, 2011, I was a guest at a convention and I left my, back in the days we had slides and trays, and I accidentally left my slides at home, and I had like 300, 400 people in a room without, you know, I wasn't a fact bringer. And on the fly, I thought, well, let's just talk about this intersection between Star Trek and entertainment and business and talk about some of this behind it. Some of the things now I talk about all the time. And that's kind of what, like, again, that was like an accidental, a little poke there. And so, but I have figured out that it's a good place to be too. I mean, I still geek out. I still want to sit down and fact every episode, you know, I still got to keep up with the star charts and help them out with the star charting on the shows. But this has been something that it feels like there was a need to do. And sadly, the more the years go by, we still have new fans, not sadly, but I mean, I have more piling up, and we have new fans who are coming in all the time, new to Star Trek, but also people that don't know the way TV's made, and who the hell even knows what the business is these days. It's just in complete flux. You're just trying to keep up with what's going on. So it's kind of a wacky place to be, but I enjoy it. I enjoy it.
Well, I think Star Trek will always be around. You're probably the most knowledgeable person about Star Trek in general. You're just like I could probably throw any, you know, obscure episode and you could probably, you know, throw facts and stuff. So,
well, now the trivia thing, it used to be easier to do that. But now what I say is, like, be careful with that. But I say, if I don't know it, then I know where to look it up, or I know who to ask and who knows where the bones are buried. So.
Great. Well, thank you again so much for your time, Larry. Like I said, everybody listening and watching, I'll leave links to where they can find you, the tours, your website, everywhere. And thanks very much for your time. Thanks again.
Oh, Anil, thank you for having me on, and good luck.
Thank you, Larry, for being a guest on the podcast. And thank all of you for listening and watching. If you're listening to the podcast, please give the Fox Nomad podcast a 5-star rating. It really helps us get out the word about the show. And if you're watching on YouTube, make sure that you give this video a like and a subscribe. Thanks very much for watching. Make sure you check out all the links down in the description or the show notes. And until the next episode, I hope you have a great rest of your day.